The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hi, good morning. Welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Also listening to us on 88.1 WSBR in Lee, Lennox, and Stockbridge. Watching us on the PCTV Select app, and maybe you're watching us on cable channel 1301, Access Pittsfield. Good morning to everyone. This is Sean Sear here with you. We're live and local this morning in our WTBR studio. Friday, August 28th already. My goodness, this will be my last morning drive for the month of August. Hard to believe already. I hope we got your summer in. Still got some nice weather coming up. I think a lot of people prefer the September weather anyway to the hot and humid summer. But, you know, we didn't have it too bad this year. Looking forward to a great show this morning. We have Joe Derwin here this morning, the home historian, talking to him about house history and how he digs into the history behind properties and houses and brings up sort of the human stories behind some of those properties. Very interesting stuff. We'll talk to him about that and also some stuff about public health and lots of things. He does some events later on in the fall that we're going to talk about as well. So lots of stuff to talk about, and stick around for that entire interview this morning. First, let's get to the weather forecast, and that is from the National Weather Service. Here we go. Berkshire
Weather. WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Rest of tonight, mostly cloudy with a 30% chance of showers. Patchy dense fog. Near steady temperature in the mid-60s. Southwest wind around 5 miles per hour. Friday, mostly sunny. Patchy dense fog in the morning. Humid with highs in the upper 70s. West wind around 5 miles per hour. Friday night, partly cloudy in the evening, then clearing. Cooler with lows around 50. Northwest wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, there you have it. And, you know, as we're getting closer to September, Pittsfield Community Television is turning 40 this year, believe it or not, and we are inviting you to join the celebration. PCTV's 40th anniversary celebration is on Friday, September 18th. That's only 3 weeks from today. At Berkshire Hills Country Club, starting at 6 p.m., you can enjoy an evening of food, fun, and dancing. The tickets are $50 each. The event will also feature a keynote address from WTEN's Ryan Peterson. Yeah, hometown boy. So go to pittsfieldtv.org right now for more information and to get your tickets. That's PCTV's 40th anniversary celebration, September 18th at Berkshire Hills Country Club at 6 p.m. And get your tickets now while you still can. Looking forward to that big event. The people are getting their tickets, and this is going to be fun. Looking forward to it. All right. Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR FM. And Joe Derwin joins me in the studio right now. Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Great. Great. 40 years, huh? Congrats.
I know. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Goes by fast.
Yeah.
Yep. We've been serving the community for that long. We've been a nonprofit organization. And some people remember our early days over on 4th Street. Mm-hmm. That was our first studio over there. Even before that, we had a group of dedicated individuals who got this organization started, and we'll be talking a lot about that at the celebration, and bringing back old videos and old photos and all kinds of stuff. We realized after a while that we are a bit of a repository here for some of Pittsfield's history.
Yeah.
Which I guess is a good segue into our talk here this morning, because history is really important. And if we don't have someone sort of on board to keep an eye on that and to know what has happened before, you know, we lose sight of that, and then we are, what is it, doomed to relive it?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, even those of us who do learn history, I feel like, are doomed to relive it if if everybody kind of, if a critical mass of people don't learn history. So
yeah, it seems like we are living in that just cycle sometimes, right? Groundhog Day.
Yeah, I feel that way a lot.
So the home historian, how did you start this project? How did you get interested in doing something like this? And tell us a little bit about sort of the process and the procedure for finding out things about old properties.
Well, I had done property research kind of a little here and there, just freelance. When I started, it was probably mostly for my friends and just kind of an offshoot of writing I was doing for the Old Advocate Weekly and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And then during the pandemic, it kind of became I was working in the arts, and the performing arts kind of like fizzled for a long time. Yeah. So I segued into, why don't I try doing this, mm-hmm. try a little advertising and see if I can make it a full-time gig. And mm-hmm. 7 years now, I think, yeah.
Has it become a full-time gig? Is this something that's taking up a majority of your time?
Yeah, this is my full-time gig for the last few years. Pretty much between doing homes and some land research, land parcels, and then outreach and, public engagements mm-hmm. and tours and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about what the process is. Somebody might be selling a house, buying a house, is interested in a particular property, and they engage you to do that, and then you start getting into the particular. So take us through that.
Yeah, I have an array of kind of different clients from new homeowners, people selling their house and looking to kind of beef up the presentation, people who are just curious. People, a lot of this time of year, I start getting a lot of gift requests for people who get like a family home that they haven't even lived in a few years, but they'll do it and they'll have like a nice, booklet made for, to give 6 or 7 different family members. And it's, this shared. But it's kind of a multi-part process where I start with deeds, of course, and start working way backwards through the ownership chain. And then that's when I start taking the names and getting into the really interesting stuff. I start kind of running the names through census, newspapers, vital records, and looking at old maps and kind of creating the story, recreating a composite of the lives of the people who live there. Because I think that's what is most interesting. I mean, if there's there's physical architectural history, which is not my primary, that's primary background. Mm-hmm. I wasn't from architecture as a background. I was an anthropology major. So it's really the human story of houses and not so much, names and dates, but trying to find the moments that happened, like real tangible moments that we can reconstruct that have maybe been buried in newspaper accounts for 100, 150 years and bring that kind of to a more recreated life for people.
It is really the human story, isn't it, that interests people, and it's this long idea of storytelling that is interwoven into that.
Yeah, because I think as people get a more, sort of egalitarian idea of things, too, we don't just care about famous people that lived in houses anymore. It's we want to know, about all kinds of people, because these are the people who, for 100, 150, 200 years stood in, where we're making breakfast in the kitchen is, presumably where they stood and, sleeping in the same place where other people slept and cried and died and, had their personal history, some of the biggest moments of people's lives happen at home. All houses are historic because everything happened there for somebody, everything, the worst or best thing that ever happened to them, the best news they ever got, these things all unfolded under, the rooftop of that, we're occupying, under the same space now. So it's really interesting to see how that connects.
Seems like one of the more interesting things too must be that let's say a plot of land that you drive by every day, or a building that you're familiar with, or something like that, and then you go back 100 150 years or something and you have a picture maybe that you've unearthed from a newspaper or from a guidebook or something, right? And somehow you're able to compare those two things and say, okay, on this plot of land, when it was such and such a house, this thing happened, right?
Yeah.
That's what I think must be the most fascinating thing. What happens when you uncover something like that?
I think it's a rush. And then it's, I think it's really interesting for people to, you know, connect that, especially, I'm really keen on cellar holes around here. We have so many all
cellar
through the Berkshires.
Holes.
Yeah. You know, places where houses used to be,
but now
you just have, you know, sometimes just a few stones kind of barely, you know, covered in moss and dirt and stuff. But, you know, like they're out in Holly, there's a area where there's several different cellar holes. And in one of them, was the first book on birth control ever written, you know, in English in the United States. Yeah. Dr. Charles Knowlton lived in this kind of small, you know, impoverished cabin that's just a pile of stones now. And you can see a big boulder over where his well was. But he wrote a book which, you know, got him put in jail for a while. Yeah, it got him put in jail. It divided the whole town of Holly. And it eventually became part of the Bradlaugh trials in the 1880s after he died and sowed the seeds for, you know, Planned Parenthood and everything that we have today.
Now, can you imagine that must have been, and you've seen the original documents, it must have come from news reports and things like that, right? What a controversy that must have been. That at the time, people would have said, people are going to remember this forever, right? And here we are, 140, 50 years later, and it's news to us.
Yeah, things become obscure surprisingly fast. Yeah, even very epic, traumatic events for communities can sometimes be forgotten in just two or three generations. It's wild.
Yeah. Except for the fact that things seem to recur, right?
Yeah.
And you've said, you know, how, you know, people live their lives and they have regular things going on. And then there are these sort of recurring themes that come through from generation to generation and even longer than that. Some of the things that we're still dealing with, I've seen some of your posts, and alcohol seems to figure in highly, whether it was the intolerance of alcohol, the prohibition of alcohol, the illegal running of alcohol, right? How that affected politics of the day, things like that. Talk a little bit about that and some of those stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think alcohol is one of the big driving factors in it. You know, when you look at New England history from the very beginning, from the colonization of Massachusetts, the Mayflower lands, you know, in this part of the world where it's not supposed to land. It wasn't supposed to land in Massachusetts at all because they're running low on beer. It was a beer calculation. And, you know, they needed that. They couldn't drink the water, you know. So they landed early, illegally, in Massachusetts, colonized this area, and it's been this recurring theme, you know, down through the centuries, and we've had ever-changing laws about, you know, restrictions on alcohol. They've tried to ban it and have prohibitory laws at a number of different points. So, you know, we talk about prohibition with the capital P as being like 1920 to 1933 or whatever, but the idea of alcohol prohibition and the saga of it in our local history goes back all the way to the beginning. And it's been going on. It's been raging since like the 10 gallon law in 1838, you know, where anything under 10 gallons was illegal to possess, to basically price out, you know, poor people from drinking and just keep it in respectable homes and so to speak. The laws, the changing, the police forces in Massachusetts locally and the state police were explicitly created to control alcohol. That was the reason to have, we didn't have any police departments in, you know, Pittsfield or surrounding towns until the 1850s. And this was a,
there was
a high sheriff of Berkshire County and, you know, they could occasionally deputize people as needed, but there was no police departments, and walking beats and things like that, until the 1850s, until you have this massive influx of Irish immigration into Massachusetts.
And there's another theme that you just brought up, right? That seems to be interwoven through some of the history that you pull up. And again, here we are in 2026 and still have not really come to grips with, you know, our nation is a nation of immigrants. And yet we're still dealing with how we feel about that.
Yeah, there's a huge ambivalence down through the centuries. Yeah, and you certainly saw that in the mid 19th century with Irish immigration, and then of course there's other waves locally. When you think of the Berkshires, there were certain patterns with the German immigrants and then Russian Jews coming over, and then just one group after another.
Italians and Polish, huge, and they built this area in so many ways,
absolutely.
Right? I mean, after the initial sort of wave of, you mentioned the Puritans and the Mayflower and sort of heading west, it certainly changed a lot when you get to the 1800s.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the population of places like Pittsfield and North Adams would be a small fraction if it was just descendants of like the original English colonists.
And a lot of them brought the skills with them too. I mean, the things that they did, I think of shoemaking or, the millwork and all the craftsmanship. In Lee, it would have been the marble work and things like that, right? And those skills all came over here.
Yeah, the skills, beliefs, traditions, things that like Halloween that are just standard part of our society now were brought by, different ethnic groups coming into the country with their own traditions and their own ideas. And certainly, my favorite thing I think to find in houses is cuisine stories. Mm-hmm. I think I wish there was more food history and less war history, but
it didn't make the newspaper. Apparently, what people were cooking.
I mean, I'm not sure we focus as much on food as we should compared to the other things we've focused on in life. Maybe we should have been cooking more and warring less. But I think it's very rich to see that day to day history unfold in houses, and because those are the things that, more than wars and treaties, a lot of times affected our lives, as traditions of like, things that, we do today because, people brought those traditions and injected them into the culture.
Joe Derwin's my guest here this morning on Morning Drive. If you're just joining us, 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. So you mentioned like titles and deeds and things like that on some of the houses that you do some research on. And it seems like one of the common themes that you bring up is that a lot of those dates are incorrect. Why is that, first of all, and how do you go about finding the accurate dates or the closest to accurate dates that you can?
It's not an exact science, I'll tell you that. The assessed dates, like the assessor's dates that are on, if you go on, say, Zillow or Realtor.com or most any real estate listing, those are guesstimates. Those are things that at the point when homes started to become assessed for tax purposes.
When was that?
Different times in different places.
Really?
Yeah, so it's, the really only the more recent decades do you have pretty accurate dates. Like a 1987 house is probably built in 1987. That one's solid, but if you look at the assessor's dates or even real estate listings on any website, there's a lot of 1900 homes. Tons of 1900, and then sometimes other rounded off dates like 1920, 1880.
And that's just a total guess on their part in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Sometimes it's an educated guess. Sometimes it's a not so much. There were different levels of skill and perception and different people that did the assessments over the decades. But I've found them to be wildly off at times. I just did a...
And what sources do you use then to sort of correct that record, to go in and say, well, it says 1900, but it was really at least as early as 1886 or 1860 or something like that?
Old maps are a part of it. Okay. Old maps come in handy, especially for certain places that were more well mapped than others in this county. But there are a variety of property maps from different eras. So you can say like, all right, well, there's nothing there, but like, just undeveloped land on the 1858 map, but here it is clear as day on the 1876 map.
So it had to be sometime between the two.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you got to rule out that it's the same, make sure it's the same house and rule out that another house didn't burn down at that spot and be replaced, because that's happened. So it's a combination of looking at Okay, so the deed from this year, they sell the land for $100, and then 2 years later, the parcel sold for $1,000. Mm. Okay, a house got built there during that 2 years. So there's a lot of clues between maps, deeds, and circumstantial newspaper reports when things got referenced, and sometimes that's a needle in a haystack. Hmm. But even very famous properties like, the old Kemble Inn in Lenox, mm-hmm. If you went on the Lenox Historical Society website right now, you'd get an incorrect date, and it would say not only an incorrect date, but it would say that it was built for, it was the home of Frederick Frelinghuysen and the president stayed there and all this business. But in fact, none of that's accurate because it was built 8 years later for his wife, his widow of Frelinghuysen. So Frelinghuysen, the Secretary of State under, was it Grover Cleveland or I think, but none of those people actually ever stayed there because they were dead before the house was actually built 8 years later.
So sometimes it sounds like this information just sort of goes into myth and legend, right?
Yeah.
It starts out accurate somewhere, and then that connection between reality and and myth, you know, sort of it grays out a little bit, right? And so maybe it's just that that word gets handed down from generation to generation, and we just take it as fact, right?
Yeah, I think we take, our brains are wired to receive information and adopt it as fact if the source isn't overtly, you know, untrustworthy to us. So, and then it's very hard to kind of let go of the first thing that we heard and accept it as fact and it's a much harder step to revise our perceptions, but
that's human nature, I think, to a certain extent, right?
Absolutely.
We want to believe what we were taught.
Absolutely.
Because someone taught it to us, and that must be correct.
Yeah.
Whatever you're telling me, you got to prove to me that that's different, right?
Yeah, and it's like an old VHS tape where you tape over it the second time, and it's not quite as, like, you know, on there.
You got to watch out for those old VHS tapes, I'm just going to say. So let's talk about a couple of projects that you've done recently that were noted. Let's see. What did you put here? There's an 1840s mixed-use property that is soon to be demolished. What is that?
Oh, yeah. Well, part of my business is properties in some towns where there's demolition regulations. You have to have historical research done for the good reason that, you know, the building could be of more importance than we know historically, and someone might actually want to save it. In Pittsfield, this came into effect because of the Samuel Harrison house, and that almost got demolished, and somebody had this obscure memory that was like, wait, what, didn't Samuel Harrison, the chaplain from the 54th Regiment? So there was this whole process of saving it.
Wow.
But
and
you know,
sometimes it goes right down to the wire, too, right? I mean, it could very easily be lost, and once it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah, and there have been things, there have been cases that went a number of different ways. So every time there's a demolition application in Pittsfield, for instance, with the application, you have to submit what's called a Form B assessment. And that's basically a historical profile that someone like me does and kind of basically who lived there and what, you know, what they were significant for and times when the building was altered and things like that. In this case, it was a building that is dated 1870 in with the city, but it's clearly showing on maps as far back as 1849. So I traced it to like 1848. But the original house had been heavily altered. There was a brick storefront addition that was added on in the 20s. As a lot of the things you look in the Fenn and East Street neighborhood, where there've been a lot of demolitions over the last few years, you see those houses where, you know, there's the front gables, kind of simple, 1800s home that had early 20th century storefront addition added to it. There's a whole bunch of, you know, less and less every year, but there's still quite a few around Fenn Street and East Street.
And that's a very old section of the city.
Very old, yeah. That's that Silver Lake neighborhood, as you go from Fenn to East, is very exciting historically, sometimes for quite unsavory reasons. There were multiple brothels along that area of Silver Lake. There was murders, attempted murders, and fracases and stabbings, and so it was a traumatic place to live in the mid to late 1800s.
And I would think those things would have been reported pretty clearly in newspapers, like they are today.
Sometimes hit or miss. I mean, journalism in the 1800s was just all over the place. Hmm. Some of it was very chatty and like a personal, somebody writing their own personal journal.
Mm-hmm. Very partisan too, right?
Yeah, so partisan. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had, in the late 1800s, you had two competing party newspapers. Mm-hmm. You know, they had the Republican Berkshire Eagle,
right,
and the more Democrat-leaning Pittsfield Sun, up until 1908, I think. So, there's a difference of opinion. There's a difference in coverage styles from one editor to the next. I mean, there are major, like, you know, crimes that today, you know, in some eras would have been front page over and over and over again, a ton of coverage. But there are some periods where there's very little we have left to us about, you know, major murders and capital crimes. So, it's pretty inconsistent. Huh. Yeah.
So back to the property there, the 1840s property in the Fenn Street neighborhood. So what's going to happen with that property, and what did you find out about it that was interesting?
Well, I kind of recreated it's somewhat of a typical working class history for that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You could kind of see how the different ethnicities follow each other, and as the city becomes a substantially Italian population in the early 20th century. So it's nothing earth-shattering, you know, particularly happened. It was interesting to see that one of my Derwin relatives had owned it for about 5 years.
Is that right?
Yeah. The Derwins of Cove Street were really big back in the day in that area. Hmm. And they bought some property nearby.
That must have been strange to see your own name pop up in there.
Yeah, it happens from time to time. Yeah. The Derwins have been in the Berkshires since the 1760s. Mm. So
you're likely to find some history.
Yeah, I mean, none of them, you know, unfortunately got too very wealthy or, you know, seem to have been prominent in politics and things like that. Although I think the first charity in Pittsfield was founded by a Derwin, by a Catholic priest at St. Joe named Derwin. So
wow, how about that? You've got another one here with architect H. Neil Wilson's home in Pittsfield. What was that?
Oh, that was a joy. That was a beautiful house on Wendell Ave, which later became the parsonage for First Congregational Church.
Okay.
But that was something where the owners knew that H. Neil Wilson had lived there. In fact, he signed, you know, there's his signature is still on one of the walls in the upstairs, which is neat.
Really?
But he was responsible for the Red Lion Inn. He designed the Red Lion Inn in the 1890s. He did the South Congregational Church in Dalton, Berkshire Place on South Street. Hmm. A lot of really gorgeous, important buildings around the 1880s and 1890s.
And ones that have survived, too.
Yeah, yeah. Some very notable landmarks that have stayed. And he did a really nice job on his personal home. But they knew, you know, as far as that, it had been his home and he designed it. But they didn't know the years were kind of mixed up in the database. Hmm. And there was this whole lost history of his wife, who was this very interesting figure in her own right. She wrote multiple books and tons of serial short stories. Hmm. And at one point she had actually, it seems like she was kind of lonely when they moved to Pittsfield. And, you know, her husband was busy with a lot of big contracts at this time. And so she invites all these single women over one night, and they form a theater troupe, just kind of on the spot.
Hmm.
And they went on to do productions for, you know, almost the next 20 years around Pittsfield, all over. It helped fund the YMCA building.
Really?
Yeah, they did all these charitable things, and it was like this amazing, the story of the Lucky 13, they called themselves, this theater troupe. And they went around did all these productions, some of them in the home itself. So that was, I'm sure, neat for the owners to find out. But it was kind of like, you know, this little chapter of Pittsfield history, which was very celebrated. They were very well known, and everybody loved to go see the Lucky 13, and they talk about it in the papers, you know, frequently. And then just, you know, it kind of just vanished and wasn't mentioned again for 120 years anywhere in print that I could find. So that's what I like, is to, you know, find things that are you know, almost at risk of being, you know, lost forever, that are really nobody's talked about in generations.
Right.
And
you almost wish there was a little repository for every house somewhere where you'd walk in and you would just say, okay, what was the history of this house? And you take it out and you look at it and you say, oh, now I understand where I'm living and what happened here.
Well, we're getting
there. Wouldn't
that
be awesome? I know, right?
I mean, it would put me out of a job if there was that database. But I love the thrill of the hunt myself.
Yeah, sounds like, and, you know, again, the storytelling is really the key feature there, right? Because it isn't so much about the architecture. Sometimes it is, but a lot of times it was about the people and the times that they lived in.
Yeah.
When they lived in those houses and what happened there. Good things and bad things, right?
Yeah, it's a mix.
Joe Derwin, my guest here, the home historian on Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. We have to take that top of the hour break. We're going to do that right now and thank our underwriters and do some station IDs and good stuff. And we'll be back with more. I want to talk to Joe about a couple of homes of past mayors of Pittsfield, and then we'll move on to a couple other topics. We'll do that right after this on Morning Drive. Here we go.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP is hiring an Assistive Technology Regional Center Program Manager to lead a dynamic program that helps individuals with disabilities gain greater independence and access to their communities. Apply today at ucpwma.org.
Still paying for that monthly gym membership? How about that streaming service you never watch? Why not support WTBR-FM instead? For just $8.97 a month, you could show your support for our community radio station today. Go to WTBRFM.com and click donate. It's as easy as that. We need to support this station to keep it on the air, and every little bit helps. WTBR-FM, for the love of radio.
Berkshire County is headed toward a brighter tomorrow, and that future begins with you. The Berkshires are on the brink of falling into a major mental health crisis. Due to the lack of access, many patients, especially children, are waiting months for appropriate care. You can help by advocating for yourself and others to find careers in mental health. Be a mental health hero for the Berkshires. For more information, please visit thebreencenter.org or namibc.org.
Support for this public service announcement comes from Berkshire Community College and Park Square Productions.
Hey, this is Mike Pezzo. Remember those tunes your parents told you to turn down? Better yet, remember those tunes your grandparents told your parents to turn down? Well, on Mike's Amazing Music and Oldies show, you'll hear sometimes oldies, sometimes blues, sometimes local performers, and a lot of rock on Berkshire County's only rock station, 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, Thursdays at noon. Tune in and be entertained and educated.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sandrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Massachusetts. Retractable awnings, retractable screen, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at Sandrini.com.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back. WTBR.
And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
All right, welcome back to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Sean Sayre here with you live this morning on Friday, August 28th. Good morning to all, and you'll be happy to know that we have Joe Derwin for the second half of the show as well. We'll be right back to that conversation in just a moment. First, one more look at the weather forecast from the National Weather Service. Here we are.
Berkshire Weather.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Rest of tonight, mostly cloudy with a 30% chance of showers. Patchy dense fog. near steady temperature in the mid-60s. Southwest wind around 5 miles per hour. Friday, mostly sunny. Patchy dense fog in the morning. Humid with highs in the upper 70s. West wind around 5 miles per hour. Friday night, partly cloudy in the evening, then clearing. Cooler with lows around 50. Northwest wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, there you have it. Some nice late August weather for you. A little bit of rain here and there. Nothing to write home about, but we'll take it. Morning Drive returns here, 89.7 WTBR-FM. And Joe Derwin, thanks again for being here this morning, talking to us about history.
My pleasure.
The things that have happened in the past that are so important to know so we don't repeat some of them. And maybe repeat the ones that are good. We'll try and do that. Let's talk about a couple more homes before we move on topics here. Notable past mayors. Mayors have to live somewhere. So are there some stories that come along with those?
Oh, there's definitely stories, especially as you go further back, because it's not so much a thing now, but mayors always lived downtown in the old days.
Okay.
You know, it's, I think, been a number of mayors now that it's more, they live more on the outskirts of town now, but they used to live, you know, Bartlett Ave, Wendell Ave, you know, very, very somewhere very central near City Hall, walking distance kind of thing. So one of the houses that I really enjoyed doing recently was the Berkshire Music School on Wendell Ave. That had been the home of Mayor Bagg, Alan Bagg, for a number of years.
And when was he the mayor of Pittsfield?
A couple of different times. He was mayor's. He was mayor from like 1906 to 1908, and then he came back in the 30s and ran for a couple more terms.
That's interesting.
Yeah, he was a real young, like he was the boy mayor, they called him, when he first ran, and then he came back middle-aged, you know, with more wealth and knowledge, and ran and was very, very popular. He was also a very colorful mayor. He lived through some interesting events, and he took a very personal. There was one time in another house that I had found a story of him taking like personal part in staking out and busting a brothel that was on Melville Street. He had been like walking the beat and just kind of taking notes and on when men and men were coming in, going from this house, and brought his notes to the police chief and kind of was like, you know, we're going to go knock on this door. He also banned circus or carnivals in Pittsfield for a long time.
Really?
Yeah. So
that would have been probably a controversial move, right? Because carnivals were very popular. Circuses.
Yeah. Circus. Well, it was like a split history because Pittsfield was very circus friendly, and we've had this very rich going back to like P.T. Barnum coming here all the time. But carnivals, as they started to manifest in the early 20th century, were considered a little bit more unsavory. You know, they were more, it was more like crooked games and stuff like that. And a lot of gambling and peep shows and, you know, other kind of scandalously sexual entertainment. So those got pushed out of Pittsfield, and they actually started going to Lanesboro, to where Baker's Golf is now.
No kidding. Just the over the line.
Yeah, the Baker family owned it then, too, in the earliest 20th century. And they would do it just over the line, kind of just like when we didn't want the mall and they went just over the line. So, Bagg was a very interesting character who owned that and the house next door, the Whitney Center, former women's club. He owned that and then moved into, after his wife died there, he moved into the house next door. So there was a lot there.
Yeah. And obviously those are notable properties. He didn't build those or have them built for himself, right?
They probably
went back
predated.
Earlier than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The music school originally was a carriage house. The oldest part of the building was a carriage house for the brick Colt building, the women's club next door to it. And then another mayor on Bartlett Ave that I recently did a house for was Daniel England. From the England brothers family.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, he was the mayor when Teddy Roosevelt famously came to Pittsfield and nearly died on South Street. So he was part of the crew of dignitaries who was like, you know, not in the car, but like in the next car behind them.
He would have been in the procession.
Yeah.
He was an important enough person to have escorted or been around the president.
Yeah, he met him downtown, I believe. Yeah. He greeted him downtown. Then he was in a carriage, you know, behind them when the trolley struck. Roosevelt's carriage. So it was
And at that point, the England Brothers store had been around for probably at least 50 years or so, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Civil War era, maybe somewhere in that range?
I think right after the Civil War, 1866 or so, Moses England. And then had gone through a couple of permutations. But yeah, they were a very known and notable family. And Daniel England and Simon England and Benjamin England and all these. But yeah, so it's... something that, you know, the owners were unaware that you know, this gentleman lived here. And it's neat to find those moments too, not just what happened in the house, but kind of imagining, like, a guy walks out your door one morning and he almost sees the president, you know, killed in front of him. It's like this concrete historical event that's tied to your home.
And sometimes we have historical markers for that to remind us. For instance, Pittsfield just put one up, I think, a year or two ago for that particular event. And that seems to come up a lot for Pittsfield. But, you know, 20, 50, 100 years from now, will we still remember it? That's the question, right? That's what the challenge of history.
Yeah, because I feel like we have plaques and markers now that go, you know, unnoticed every day.
Mm-hmm. And walk right over it.
Yeah. But the Roosevelt story was one of those things that I feel like 15, 20 years ago, it was pretty obscure. And then people got started to get interested in it. And then the last couple of decades, it's been like a popular story.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about another theme that seems to wind its way through. And when you're doing your historical research, you find a lot of gravestones of very, very young individuals.
Oh, so many.
Right.
So many.
And I guess, again, because of our modern era, of the things that the science has tackled, a lot of infantile diseases, that we haven't had to deal with that quite as much until the last couple of years. But talk about the sort of devastation that families went through at the time of having, you know, sometimes half of their family decimated by childhood diseases or other diseases.
Oh, yeah. It was...
You see a lot of small gravestones, right?
Yeah, a lot of small gravestones. And then there's a lot of places where, you know, they didn't even get gravestones, but they're there in the death records. And you can see, you know, you can look at just a sheet of months. I was looking, I think, from one at Pittsfield in 1892 the other day, and almost nobody was over 65 in the deaths that whole month. It was just like almost everybody was one or under. And that was because measles had just come through that year. There had been an outbreak starting in South County. A couple people died of measles there. And then more people died, not of measles, but the devastating thing with measles is that after effect of, we now know scientifically that it devastates the immune system.
Right. It wipes out the memory, basically, of everything else. So you're now susceptible to so many other diseases.
Yeah. And it does it also, most sadly, for mothers, infants, fetuses, for 2 to 3 years. So you just, there's periods where you see this wave of fever death, you know, infantum, you know. So all these people dying with, like, low-level infections they might otherwise have survived. But they have no immune system left because measles has come through.
So I think that it feels like there's this, you know, theme that goes through. People say, well, these were childhood diseases and everybody got them and we got through it and we lived through it and we're fine. And so, you know, what do we need all the vaccines for to prevent us from that? That seems to be a very misguided thought as well, I must say. Because probably we've since the, what, late 50s, early 60s, had vaccines for a lot of these childhood diseases that have made the most of the population immune from it. So we've kind of forgotten, right, how bad it could be.
Yeah, vaccines are the only reason that people can say these are just not a big deal childhood diseases. These were horror stories for past generations. And it's very untrue when people say that, like, you know, the numbers had already gone, you know, this had stopped being a problem long before the vaccine, you know, as we got cleaner water and better plumbing and things like that. Because it's, you look at, say, the early 60s before anybody was immunized for measles, and then you're still seeing like 400 or 500 deaths a year in the U.S., mostly children. Cut to by 1970, by the end of the 60s, really, when the big, you know, push to get everybody immunized had happened, there's like no deaths. There's like, it's down to like one or two deaths, and then there's like zero 1 year, and then they're like, And then, you know, 30 years after that, we're basically to a point, you know, we'd been to a point where measles was declared, you know, kind of, it was like a non-thing. Mm-hmm. So,
and there are varying different
eradicated.
Yeah, varying different regulations and allowances for vaccines these days too, right? Where there are religious exemptions for it, and there's just a kind of a wild card exemption in some states where they say, well, you know, if you don't want it, you can still come to school.
Yeah, it's a real dumb move.
Yeah,
New York doesn't do it, but Massachusetts mm-hmm. certainly does, mm-hmm. and I don't see any real movement from our legislators to do anything about that, even though it's clearly a fatalistic place to be. With what we're hearing, I think this week there were just two deaths from measles reported in Pennsylvania.
Right.
There's cases in Connecticut. There's cases in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Like, the herd immunity has to be around 95% to keep measles from circulating mm-hmm. in a population. We have multiple schools in Berkshire County that are below that right mm-hmm. now. We haven't declared it, but we have, in effect, in some school population, lost herd immunity. And that endangers everybody, including the vaccinated families that have taken those steps, because if they've got a newborn baby, that they're not getting vaccinated for the first year of their life, mm-hmm. you know, fully for MMR.
And it's not going to stay in the schools, right?
Yeah, it will go everywhere. It's measles. Incredibly transmissible.
Yeah. And so it ends up in families, and then it ends up in newborns, and then you got a real epidemic on your hands.
And it'll transmit faster now because people mm-hmm. didn't have so many cars, trains, planes. It will go all over the place mm-hmm. much faster than it did in 1910, you know?
How about the history of things like foodborne illnesses and the protections for food, where that all came into place sometime after the, you know, 1910s, in that era when there was a big outcry about how food wasn't safe? And then, you know, we're getting now to the MAHA movement, and where we're, you know, trying to get rid of red food dye number 3 or whatever, but we're also, you know, getting rid of pasteurization for milk. I'm exaggerating there a little bit, but I mean, those kinds of things. Are we coming back around on that cycle of history as well?
Yeah, it's very reminiscent, because it's interesting that I think a lot of the food regulation that was achieved came through women's suffrage. This was one of the hot button issues in the 1910s that brought a lot of mothers into the fold who hadn't maybe 10 years or 20 years earlier thought that much about voting. Mm. All of a sudden, you get to a point in the 1910s where people are getting a lot more of their food mass produced than their mothers or grandmothers did.
It wasn't just coming from the garden.
Yeah, it's not all local anymore. Mm-hmm. You're getting a ton of food products made in factories and shipped from elsewhere. There's a huge wave of interest in mothers.
Meat packing, for instance.
Oh, yeah, meat packing and all kinds of, I mean, even like, you know, flour and all these different things. You know, there's a huge boom in food production, mass production, and people got very interested in having a say. Mothers got interested in having a say in how that was being done and regulated and inspected. Because one of the things I see a lot, you know, you'll see a lot of cases of edema, or they call it dropsy in the old death records, dropsy. And it was, you know, somewhat expected in older patients. But when you see it in childhood cases, and there were sadly a lot of childhood cases where children died of dropsy, and this edema was mostly caused, they think now, by prickly pear contamination in mustard.
Really?
Yeah, in bought mustard powders and things like that. Hmm. So that was a major killer. Hmm. And I've seen, you know, I could point to several graves around here for children that just died from that sort of thing. So, you know, yeah, the food regulation, and now as we see some of that, you know, process, I think 3,000 support staff for the FDA's food inspection, you know, food inspectors were cut, you know, recently by the federal government and things like that. And now we're seeing these mass contaminations and, you know, really ugly illness spreading.
It seems like some of that is not going to be easily reversible or repairable, right? And that's kind of the more worrisome thing. It's like it took 90 years or whatever to build up the idea of protecting people from, you know, poor quality food, essentially, or practices, or whatever it is that, you know, food storage or spoilage or whatever it is that, that created the illnesses. And if we're going to roll that back, how long will it take to come back again and say, well, you know what, we need some of that stuff?
Oh, I think it's, yeah, I think it's going to be a big problem until there is mass death in this country, I think, before we, because we've, it's not just the policy, it's the underlying faith in scientific method and methodology and the understanding, I think, of how science works and how we achieve, there's a growing idea of conspiracy theory, you know, across left, right, all ideologies.
With no evidence, really, right?
Yeah, no evidence or distorted evidence. A huge amount of propaganda and misinformation has been churned out, you know, sometimes by foreign actors. And, you know, so we're under, we're being barraged by misinformation messages in the internet age.
It's hard to find a trusted source of information. And it, I think, goes back to what you said in the first half of the show. Once you got something stuck in your brain that you think is the right thing or the real thing, it's very, very difficult to dislodge that, even though you're coming with legitimate evidence and, you know, peer-reviewed studies and multiple evidentiary, you know, documents that say you really got this wrong. You got to rethink this.
Yeah. And they've done studies showing now that, that you can't spread the accurate correction. You can't debunk as fast or as, you know, it takes much more energy and resources to spread correct information than misinformation. That travels much faster.
I think we've all seen the evidence of that in social media, where the bad news, the bad stuff travels very, very fast.
Yeah, toxic nonsense will just go everywhere very quickly. Accurate, well thought out, rational positions are not so much.
Joe Derwin's my guest here this morning on 89.7 WTBR FM's Morning Drive. Just a few minutes left of the show. Do want to talk about busting some myths, because again, that kind of goes to history and evidence. And sometimes we just like the stories that we have because they fit the narrative. But sometimes we also have to take some reality back and say that these things didn't actually happen. And you know what? We can just say, hey, I didn't know that, right? I mean, maybe we need a little more humility and say, huh, I always thought that. But now that I hear what you're saying, I understand. What are some of the big myths that you've looked at and tried to bust here in Berkshire County?
Gosh, there's so many because I think so much of our history has gotten befuddled. But you know, the idea of Pittsfield and baseball is something that I recently touched on in my Eagle column. I think there was a huge amount of premature hype about and it keeps changing over the years. The you know, keeps having to backpedal. At first, it was first mention of baseball in America was in Pittsfield. Okay, well, no, not the first mention, but the first mention in a government document, or the first ban on baseball. I personally think, based on circumstantial evidence of the times, that the 1791 reference to baseball in Pittsfield wasn't even to baseball as we know it. It was to a sport called rounders that was called baseball.
Similar to
at that time, yeah, similar to and part of probably inspiration for baseball.
But it's undeniable that we have a long history of baseball in Berkshire County. That's reasonable to say. It's probably also reasonable to say that baseball was not invented by Abner Doubleday, right?
No, but it does seem to have come to the Berkshires from New York.
Okay.
The first bona fide evidence of it being played, the earliest mentions of it actually being played in the Berkshires, are in the 1850s, and it's it starts at a Lanesboro boys' school as the very first team. And the way they mention this new baseball team is kind of the way people talked about pickleball like 10, 15 years ago. It was like this new thing. Because you notice all these things that were in the 1791 baseball byline. They mentioned cricket and all these other games. Those are all mentioned again pretty regularly in newspapers it locally all through the early 1800s. There's no mention of the word baseball again. So I think it was just thrown in there as a bunch of games. So there's no real evidence it was even being played, even as rounders, in Pittsfield in the 1700s. Then all of a sudden, the very next mention, real mention, is in the 1850s. And then it's like starts being a ton of mentions. So it's like it caught fire, you know.
Interesting. Pontoozuck Lake. Is it a natural lake or no?
It is a natural lake by the definition. It is an expanded lake. It was dammed to expand it widely, but it was a pretty decently large lake to begin with, much bigger than, say, Silver Lake. It existed long before there were humans in the Berkshires.
But not as big as it is today because it was dammed and...
Dammed and greatly expanded by, you know, 100 acres or so.
But there are some man-made lakes here in Berkshire County, and I think of, isn't it the Hoosick Reservoir that was originally meant for, like, the Arnold Printworks and Adams? That was, I don't know that that was a lake ahead of time, but I'm pretty sure that they made it larger.
For
that purpose, for getting the water into the factory.
Yeah, that's one. Basin Pond in Lee is another one that was just like a maybe like a 1 acre puddle. Essentially, it was like a tiny little pond, and they dammed that to create a much bigger lake for the mills there. So yeah, we have radically shifted the water bodies of water and the courses of rivers and streams in the Berkshires. From you look at the old maps, and it's quite different from what we see on a topographical map now.
And that was pretty common right up until probably the early 70s when the conservation movement came in and he said, well, you know, if you're dealing with a body of water, you got to come through the Conservation Commission, or, you know, you got to be really careful with that stuff.
Yeah, now we're still altering it, but kind of in the opposite direction. We're taking out dams and, you know.
Yeah, like the one down on Wakona Street, for example.
Yeah, that was a very old
Bel Air dam,
1800s dam.
Yeah. And again, meant for factory use, and you know, it was highly contaminated. So it's good to see something like that go and to open up the river to the sort of natural state that it's in.
Yeah, I think there's some sad nostalgia for, you know, some people just to not see it there. You know, when they grew up in that neighborhood and goofed around in the stream, you know, the river and stuff. But
yeah, how about the Red Lion Inn? Not as old as they say it is. Still very old.
Yeah, it's still old. I mean, you know, 1890s is respectably old, but the yeah, I think...
And something happened at that location earlier than that, because it was a major route, right? It was a major transportation route.
Yes. There had been inns and taverns of varying names there since the late 1700s. They weren't the same as the Red Lion Inn. Actually, the original Red Lion Tavern of 1770s era was in Lee, not Stockbridge at all. And so it's kind of like saying... You know, when they say established 1773, it's like saying, you know, the Holiday Inn near Park Square is from, you know, the 1820s. Because there technically have been hotels and inns on that site.
But
can you claim that all as, you know, or Down Street Hotel in North Adams? I mean, I guess that's established, you know, in 1830 because, you know, it was the early 1800s. So it's... You know, whether we can claim buildings and other business names that were there before us as part of our legacy is an interesting question.
Yeah. Muddy history at best, right? Joe Derwin, upcoming events. We got about a minute left. What do you got coming up?
This October, I'll be giving tours in downtown Pittsfield covering the macabre 1800s and the 1920s. It's kind of a sequel series of history of downtown. I'll also be giving my graveyard tours again in Pittsfield Cemetery. And also for an exclusive tour for members and subscribers to my Patreon, we're doing a guided hike in Savoy into some very old abandoned areas. So you can find all more about that on thesemysterioushills.com.
There you have it. So that's the best way to get in touch with you, to connect and find out about the events you got coming up.
Yeah, come to my website, thesemysterioushills.com, or berkshirehomehistory.com if you need home research.
Great. Well, as always, I knew it would be fascinating to talk to you this morning. Lots of great stories and interesting history. History is always very interesting to me. I wish more people would take it seriously and take a moment out of their day and think about what happened before and how that affects their lives going forward. Joe Derwin, thanks again for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And you, everybody out there, have a great day and a great weekend. Enjoy. It sounds like it's going to be halfway decent tomorrow, so maybe time to mow the lawn and have some fun. All right. Take care, everybody.